Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's close to midnight. Something evil's lurking in the dark. Under the moonlight, you see a sight that almost stops your heart. You try to scream, but dare I take the sound before you make it.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Coming up later on our show, guitarist Elliot Sharp gives us a live performance of an arrangement of music by Thelonious Monk, and we'll look at how studying music might help you learn a language. But first, from Mahalia Jackson to Michael Jackson, Sinatra to Santana, Johnny Cash to Johnny Cougar Mellencamp, everyone from Miles to Nas, when you look at the list, it feels like just about every big name in music has spent some time on Columbia Records. As the last installment in our series looking at record labels today, we thought we'd look back at the oldest record label. Gary Marmerstein has recently published a book chronicling the first century of Columbia's long history. The book is called simply The Label. Gary, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you, John.
So the book came out on Monday. Why an entire book on just one record label?
Well, I think the history is pretty rich. My feeling was if I couldn't get the history of recording to some extent in that one book, it wasn't worth doing.
So it's a case study that gives us basically the history of recorded sound.
Yeah, Columbia started as a distributor for American Phonograph, which was in what we now regard as the dictaphone business. It was a talking machine company, and it focused on the mid-Atlantic states and Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. So it started as a distribution agency for these kind of spoken word recordings, things
right.
like that.
Right. It was the distribution arm for American.
Okay. And this would have been what, 1888?
Yeah, 1887, 1888, and then by 89, Columbia was recording on its own.
Uh-huh. So very quickly became its own thing as a record label. Right. When did they start recording music?
I think by 1891, a lot of music was coming out of Columbia mm-hmm. very quickly. The president at the time was Edward Easton, who took a cross-country trip to investigate his distributorships, and he discovered that the customers wanted to hear music more than they wanted to hear talking.
All right, well, works for us, obviously.
mm-hmm.
So that was the beginnings of what has turned out to be this kind of signature brand. The label really carried a lot of cachet, it seems, throughout much of the 20th century. In those early days, was it the only place where people could actually go to get recorded and know that there was going to be this kind of, you know, built-in distribution to get the recording around the country?
Well, in the early decades of the 20th century, there were quite a few other labels, and Victor was much bigger. Victor started a few years later than Columbia. But if you think about the logo itself, Victor had Nipper, the dog,
right,
with his ear cocked to the
recording horn.
To the recording horn, exactly. And the logo became so popular that Victor exploded.
Okay.
And was the dominant label for the first couple of decades of the century.
Which didn't stop people like Bessie Smith from going to Columbia to make records there. This one from the 1920s is called Gimme a Pigfoot.
You can hear old Hannah say, Gimme a Pigfoot. Yeah, when he stomps his feet.
That's Bessie Smith. She recorded Gimme a Pig Foot in the 1920s for Columbia Records, which by that point was a pretty well-established label. Gary Marmerstein is the author of the book called simply The Label, which traces the first 100 years of Columbia from 1888 to 1988. Watershed moment, Gary, in 1938. So really, pretty much splitting that century directly in half, when CBS bought Columbia.
Right, John. The ironic thing about CBS's purchase was that Columbia Records gave its name to the Columbia Broadcasting Company, Columbia Broadcasting System.
Sir, yeah, system.
In the first place. Mm-hmm. What happened was a decade earlier, William Paley and a few other people had decided to start a radio network here in New York and other eastern cities to challenge NBC. And Columbia Phonograph was the largest supporter of that particular combine. And then after 18 months or so, Paley let go of Columbia Phonograph but kept the name.
So CBS, Columbia Broadcasting System, then ended up buying what had been, in a sense, its kind of parent.
Correct. I mean,
there was some of its DNA right. in CBS to begin with.
Exactly. The company that gave it its name. And those were the beginning of the CBS years, which for me makes for a fascinating history because CBS was in the business of making money. Of course, it wanted to record as much music as possible and the best music, but they wanted a profit.
And so Columbia became, as a brand, something that they kind of built up so that, I mean, were listeners sort of cued into Columbia, you know, to the point where if they didn't know the name of the artist, because it was on Columbia, they would go and buy it?
That took a while. I believe the first pop hit that Columbia had came about a year or so after CBS bought it, and it was a version of Oh Johnny Oh, which was going back to World War I. But this was by Orrin Tucker and Bonnie Baker. Wee Bonnie Baker was the singer. And at that point, Columbia Records got into the pop music business again under CBS. Up until then, it had a fairly sized classical catalog.
Well, and it seems like, you know, it was the classical artists in the middle of the 20th century who led the way for Columbia, and I guess foremost among them would have been Leonard Bernstein.
Oh, yes. Well, that Leonard Bernstein had a connection to television that made everything explode. The Young People's Concerts, CBS adored Leonard Bernstein. It's fair to say, I think, unless you can come up with someone else, that he was the first telegenic conductor.
He was young, he was good-looking, he had enthusiasm, he was articulate, he could sort of convey his enthusiasm to a television audience. As you say, CBS was in the business of making money, and when they could make good art and make a lot of money, they must have been very happy with Leonard Bernstein. America, of course, is from Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, and he was one of the big artists on Columbia Records. We're talking about the first 100 years of the historic record label with author Gary Marmerstein. His book, called simply The Label, was published day before yesterday. He's here with us today on Soundcheck. Both in terms of jazz, you know, what we would now call classic jazz, as well as classical music, the Columbia roster was packed. And you write that that's in large part due to the fact that the executive producers, the A&R, the artist and repertoire people at the label were all musicians themselves.
Right, John. Excuse me. Yeah, that was not so common among record labels at the time. I'm not so sure it's common now. Hmm. The president through the 50s, or from the mid-50s on, was Goddard Lieberson. But even before Lieberson became president, musicians were running the company, and they hired musicians. Lieberson liked to say that it's easier to turn a musician into a businessman than a businessman into a musician. And he liked having musicians in those roles as either producers or A&R men or both. I think it's the equivalent of, to some extent, of a great editor who may not have written a novel but knows how to edit the novelist.
Right. Now, I mean, we don't, as a rule in the general public, take note of A&R people. But the names John Hammond and George Avakian have a certain renown because, you know, I mean, John Hammond discovered everyone from Benny Goodman to Bob Dylan to, you know,
that's,
I mean,
true,
just
right.
Over the decades, the guy just continually churned out one star after another. What did those guys bring to the table? How influential were they in charting the course of Columbia Records?
Well, it's fair to say that John Hammond was, in fact, a musician. He played the viola and the violin, and he had great ears. He was with Columbia as early as 1932. He was recording for Columbia and then left several times. Through the late 40s and most of the 50s, John Hammond was not at Columbia. George Avakian was, and Avakian was hired as a Yale College student to put together some various jazz records, including Louis Armstrong, most famously Louis Armstrong. And then he went to war, and it's when he came back that he started to build that catalog that we now think of as classic jazz. It took a while, mm-hmm. but it took a while because there were other developments like the long playing record.
Right, which, you know, allowed jazz musicians to improvise. You know, they didn't have to just,
that's,
you know,
right.
play the tune for 3 minutes and get out, you know. Right. Like classical musicians could do an entire symphony.
That completely changed the recording industry.
And, you know, eventually would lead to things like, and I know this wasn't on Columbia, but when Frank Sinatra did those first sort of concept albums in the Wee Small Hours and Only the Lonely, you know, those were sets of songs, but they were seen as a kind of composite whole. Now, Sinatra did spend a little bit of time at Columbia, and that's a story, too.
Sinatra spent a lot of time at Columbia. He was recording with Harry James in 1939, as I recall, and he was known as Harry James's singer. And then the Second World War made the big band considerably less popular, or was eclipsed by the singer, including Sinatra. Sinatra was hired on his own at Columbia, and the man who hired him was Manny Sax, who came out of Philadelphia and, in fact, was related to one of the founders of the Columbia Broadcasting System. Manny Sax left in 1950 because he did not get the promotion he wanted. So at that point, Sinatra had been recording for the label for about 6 years, and those are beautiful, beautiful recordings. But not yet the
fully mature.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, this is Frank Sinatra in those years with Columbia and the song Close to You.
Can't you see? You're my happiness. Wherever you go, my heart will go too. What can I do? It only wants to be close to you.
Close to me. Sharing your career.
Frank Sinatra, Close to You, the first song that he recorded for Columbia Records, I guess first song after you know, sort of striking out on his own after being the boy singer for a couple of big bands. We're speaking with Gary Marmorstein, whose book is called The Label, The Story of Columbia Records. There is a story in how Sinatra left Columbia Records as well, and it involves none other than Mitch Miller, Mr. Yellow Rose of Texas himself.
Right, John. When Manny Sachs left Columbia and went to, as I recall, RCA, the label needed a new director of recording. And Goddard Lieberson went to Mercury, where Mitch Miller was head of recording there, pop recording, and asked if he wanted to come over to Columbia. So Mitch Miller did. And Mitch is a very authoritative, dominant presence in and out of the recording studio. And it's hard to say whether he overpowered Sinatra or Sinatra was just going through a bad time anyway. My own sense is that Sinatra's life was in a shambles, his personal life as well. And
he was in the middle of a messy breakup with Ava Gardner at the time, right?
With Ava Gardner, and he had a television show that you can actually see the evidence of Sinatra getting weaker and weaker.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there are people who say that Mitch Miller just overpowered him, and that was the thing that spurred him to leave.
All right. Now, you alluded before to the importance of the development of the LP, the long playing record, which was a Columbia invention. Excuse me. And I guess for a while, they were the only ones with the format, right?
Well, it wasn't for too long. RCA kept insisting they were not going to go to the LP, but the LP took over.
Mm-hmm. So what did that do for, you know, I mean, we talked a few minutes ago about how it allowed jazz musicians, for example, to stretch out and give us a genuine sense of their art. It seems like you suggest that maybe Columbia was, despite being a step ahead with the technology, maybe a step behind in terms of getting the real adventurous jazz and stuff like that. Why is that?
Well, I think they didn't have the people in place. George Avakian was then the head of international recording and also of pop albums. Of course, pop albums, as we know them, really didn't come into being until the LP. But it just took a while to build that catalog to bring people over. There were some wonderful, wonderful jazz people, a lot of Benny Goodman recordings, later on Armstrong, of course. But the 1950s signings, like Dave Brubeck and Miles Davis, those are the people that we often think of as Columbia art, great Columbia jazz artists.
Right. So if they did start off a step slow, they caught up pretty fast. Here's Dave Brubeck. Take five from Dave Brubeck, classic recording on Columbia Records, and author Gary Marmorstein is with us. His new book is called The Label, The Story of Columbia Records. And if they were, Gary, a step slow in getting the most adventurous jazz, were they maybe two steps slow in adopting rock and roll?
That was also largely due to Mitch Miller's antipathy to rock and roll. Goddard Lieberson, who was the president, was kind of indifferent, and he allowed Mitch to have the say-so on what was acceptable, what wasn't. There was some rock and roll on Epic, which was Columbia's major subsidiary, which started in 1953 and became the Michael Jackson label, among others. But for the most part, Mitch Miller just did not want to deal with rock and roll. He hated it.
But it's funny that, I mean, you mentioned before, you know, they were owned by CBS. They wanted to make money. Rock and roll was making a lot of money. And it seems very, just from a business standpoint, a very strange decision.
Well, I don't know that there was any single decision, John, made. It was just that there was Mitch at the ramparts. He made a
holding off the barbarian hordes.
Exactly. He made a famous speech in Kansas City to disc jockeys decrying rock and roll, and it just was not what he wanted at that label.
So they were willing to sign Bob Dylan, brought to them again by John Hammond, but he was a folkie. Then he plugged in, famously, at Newport, and suddenly he's not a folkie anymore, and you've got electric guitars on Columbia. Did they stand behind him?
Very much so. There are people who would say otherwise, but they knew what they had, especially when Highway 61 came out.
Here's Bob Dylan.
Once upon a time you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. How does it feel?
From Bob Dylan's Highway 61, Like a Rolling Stone, and we are looking at the history, at least the first 100 years of the long history of Columbia Records with author Gary Marmorstein. Gary, your book ends in 1988, 100 years after the founding of Columbia. It also happens to be the year that the label was bought by Sony. Is that the end, in your mind at least, of the quote-unquote real Columbia?
Well, I think the business in general, John, was changing in 1988. Was a good place to stop because of that changeover. What Columbia no longer had and what many of the other labels did not have any longer were house producers, house A&R men. Columbia had let go of its major studio, the 30th Street Studio, a few years earlier. A lot of those great recordings were made at either 30th Street or on 52nd Street, and they're just different now.
All right. So, I mean, there's been a big paradigm shift in the industry. It's why we've been doing this three-part series on record labels on Soundcheck, and 1988, a watershed year in the history of Columbia. The first 100 years are documented in Gary Marmorstein's new book, The Label, The Story of Columbia Records. Gary, it's a long and strange tale. Thanks for joining us today to tell us some of it.
Thank you for having me, John.
Coming up next on Soundcheck, guitarist Elliot Sharp reinterprets the music of yet another Columbia artist, this one, Thelonious Monk, but on guitar. That's coming up next on Soundcheck.